Good morning, everybody. So Parshas Truma, what do we talk about when we have Parshas Truma? It's not easy. I think everywhere else in the world where they have a halacha shir on Parshas Truma, they speak about binyan beis hamikdash and what exactly the parameters are and who's allowed to build a beis hamikdash and are women allowed to build a beis hamikdash and young children and non-Jews. And it's a major discussion, and maybe we'll have that discussion another time, but I thought maybe we'll use this morning as a time to discuss something which is quite interesting. And it's something which I believe all of us have encountered in some way, but probably know very little about. So that's why I thought it was a nice idea to choose this topic this morning, which is Derech Gedilasan Belulav and Bekiya Mitzvah HaTorah. Now, what exactly does that mean? If you look at the header, I'm sure many of us don't even understand what the header is supposed to mean. Atzei Shitim Omdim, anybody know what that means? Well, that's actually a pasuk in this week's Parsha, and that's what our shir is going to be about. So by way of introduction, let's begin with the following. What?
The song we used to sing.
Oh, the song, I don't know. Okay. I'm not that much younger, but... Okay, so let's begin like this, by way of introduction. We find throughout the year that we recite three different categories of brachos on different occasions. And the three categories, I think we spoke about this a couple of weeks ago, let's just review, because it's important for our discussion today. The three different types of brachos are, number one, a birchas hane'anin, which means when I'm about to eat, when I'm about to drink, when I'm about to have hana'ah from something, when I'm about to have pleasure, I have to recite a bracha. The second category is a birchas hashevach, which means when I'm overwhelmed by the beauty or the nature or the understanding of God's world, I have to recite a bracha because I have to put that into words. I have to put that experience into words. And the third bracha that we have is what we call a birchas hamitzvah. Upon the performance of any given mitzvah, one has to recite a bracha, like we find on shofar, on lulav, on tzitzis, on everything else, on Neir Shabbos, everything we do throughout the year, we always recite a bracha. Now there's a major difference between these three categories. There are many nuanced differences, but the three categories have one very, very fundamental difference, and that is the following. By birchas hane'anin, when I make a bracha on a food item before I eat or before I drink, one has to recite the bracha before gaining that pleasure, before eating, before drinking. Like we find the Gemara says in Maseches Brachos Daf Lamed Hei, which is the first entry on the Sorshi, kol hane'anin min ha'olam hazeh b'lo bracha, anyone who has any sort of benefit, any pleasure from olam hazeh without reciting a bracha before taking that pleasure, ki'ilu mal, it is as if you have violated an Isser Me'ila. Now, what does that mean? It's as if you have stolen from God Himself if you eat or drink something without reciting a bracha. So that's a very important concept. And from here we learn that one has to recite a bracha before eating the food or before drinking the drink. What if a person forgets? Would you ever recite a bracha after you've already eaten or drank? No. Why? Because the mitzvah is to recite the bracha before, because that's somehow my allowance. That's what gives me an allowance to eat or drink, consume this item. The second category we find is a birchas hashevach. For example, I go to Niagara Falls, I go to the Grand Canyon, and I'm so overwhelmed by the experience that I see, I have to recite a bracha. When do you recite that bracha? Afterward. Why? Because the Rishonim say, after, I don't know if I'm going to be so overwhelmed. I don't know if Niagara Falls is going to be so exciting for me. I don't know if the thunder and lightning is really going to do it for me. And therefore, we recite the bracha after we take in the experience. And we're so overwhelmed by the beauty, by the nature, by God's world, by God's creation. Then we evoke a response of a bracha afterwards. So that's why, let's say, thunder and lightning, I guess you never know when it's going to come. But so that's an obvious reason why it has to be afterward. But let's say you go to the Yam HaGadol, you go to the Mediterranean, you go to one of the big oceans, or you go to some wonder of nature, you only recite the bracha after you have the experience. So now we come to the third category of brachas, and that is a birchas hamitzvah. And the Gemara discusses, both in Maseches Sukkah, Daf Lamedtes, as well as in Psachim in the first perek, when should the bracha be recited on a mitzvah? Should you recite the bracha beforehand, like a food item? Or should you recite the bracha afterward, like you would recite on a birchas hashevach? So how do you fit this category in? What would you say? Says the Gemara, kala mitzvos kulan mevarech aleihem over la'asiyasan. You always have to recite the bracha before the performance of the mitzvah. That's clear. That's what the Gemara tells us. And therefore, that is what we do. The only exception, as to go, is? What? Neiro Shabbos, not a good exception. Not such a good one. I think you said that last time. But so you're consistent, at least. No, you're consistent. It's good. Because Neir Shabbos, the Gemara doesn't discuss. It's a good example because practically we do make the bracha afterward, but the Gemara gives the exception to the rule is Mikvah Netilas Yadayim. So Mikvah Netilas Yadayim, why do we recite the bracha after going into the mikvah and then you come up, then you say the bracha, why do we do that? Netilas Yadayim, why do we recite the bracha after we wash our hands? Shouldn't that be the same as any other mitzvah that we perform throughout the year? Shofar, you don't recite the bracha after you blow shofar. Lulav, you don't recite the bracha after you shake the lulav. Every time you perform a mitzvah, you recite the bracha beforehand. So why is Mikvah Netilas Yadayim any different? Well, the Rishonim explained the reason for mikvah is because we are going to get confused with the tefillah of a non-Jew who is becoming a ger. So what happens? You can't make a bracha before you go into the mikvah al ha-tefillah because he's not a Jew. Asher k'dishanam imtzos v'tzivanu, God commanded me to go into the mikvah. It's not true. God didn't ask me to become a ger. I decided that I want to become a ger. So therefore, since the ger, when they go into the mikvah for the process of conversion, have to recite a bracha, and that bracha can only be recited afterward, well, so too, we don't want to confuse anybody, so therefore, we always have the baseline that this is what everybody does when they go to the mikvah, both men and women, they recite a bracha after they come up from the mikvah experience. That's the story with mikvah. Now, what about Netilas Yadayim? What about Netilas Yadayim? How come we don't recite a bracha before? So there, the Rishonim explained the reason why is because by Netilas Yadayim, very often a person will be coming out of the washroom and we're concerned you're not going to be allowed to recite a bracha until you wash your hands. And sometimes your hands are going to be dirty and it's not right to recite a bracha at that point. So therefore, we say across the board, everyone should make sure to only recite the bracha al Netilas Yadayim after one washes their hands. These are the two exceptions to the rule. Every other case, we assume you recite the bracha before performing the mitzvah. Now, says the Ritva, why is it that we recite a bracha before performing a mitzvah? What is this all about? Explains the Ritva very simply. We want that everybody who sees you performing this act should know, without understanding anything else, they should know right away that what you're doing is only because God told you to do it. When I'm walking around with a lulav and an esrog on Sukkot, it's not because I love fruits and I love vegetables and I love plants and I think the colors are beautiful. Nobody should think that. Everyone who sees me, the outsider's perspective should be right away that it's clear that I'm doing this only because God asked me to do it. And therefore, by reciting a bracha before you do it, you make that very clear. That's the way the Rishonim explain the reason why the bracha was instituted before the performance of a mitzvah. Yeah. Yeah. Not supposed to.
You make a bracha and then you not
that. I mean, talus for sure. You do that. We'll get to that in a second, right?
I wasn't gonna ask. My sons don't.
So your sons are married or single? They're little boys. So tzitzis is, you know, a little bit different. Certainly by a talus. Right. Certainly by a talus you make the bracha before. Tzitzis, sometimes, you know, people put them on and then they make the bracha. It's a little bit hard to get it right. So I think for young children, they explain to them that they should do it that way. But again, that's a mitzvah mimushach. That's a mitzvah that takes place all the time while they're wearing the tzitzis. So it's not like you're over. It's not like once I blow the shofar, now the mitzvah's over, so you can't make a bracha anymore. Here, the tzitzis, once I put them on, I have a mitzvah that continues all day long. It's a very good question. But the reason the Gemara says over here, it's a very strange terminology. If I would ask you, how would you express yourself if you're trying to teach anybody else that you're supposed to recite a bracha before performing a mitzvah? Which word would you use? Kala mitzvah kula mevarach aleihem blank la'asiyasan. You should make a bracha before you perform them. Which word would you stick in there? Lifnei, kodem. Those are the general words that we find being used for the word before. Over here, we come up with a strange word, over. And the Gemara is not even sure what over means. The Gemara says, does over mean before? Does it mean after? We have to bring proofs from all different psukim all over the place. So why do we use such a strange terminology? Why don't you just say the regular word, kodem, lifnei, any other word that we would use in any other context? And the Rishonim write, the reason why is because we're trying to teach something different here. And that is, if the Gemara would have only said lifnei asiyas, and you would say, okay, at some point before you shake the lulav, at some point before you blow the shofar, make sure you make a bracha. From the fact that the Gemara uses a very different kind of phraseology than it would normally have used, it's coming to teach us that it has to be over, meaning right before, immediately before, and it shouldn't be too much in advance. Now, that has very practical ramifications. Take, for example, how many people in this room slice the challah on Shabbos, or whoever cuts the challah in your house, the man or the woman, whoever it might be, how many people slice the challah, have seen this challah sliced before you make the bracha? Right? I assume everybody does that. You take the knife and you make a little slice before you start, correct?
No.
No, you don't? Why not? Not that you cut a piece off. You make a little indentation, right? So what is that all about? Anyone ever think about it? What is that all about, right? So what that's all about is the Shulchan Aruch explains as follows. Because one is supposed to recite the bracha as close as possible to performing the act, so therefore what's going to happen? I have a big challah on Shabbos, and it's going to take me 35 seconds to cut pieces for everybody at the table. So to make it 1 second faster, what I do is I take the knife, and before I recite the bracha, I make a slit, so that this way it will be easier for me, after the bracha is recited, to then go ahead and finish off that cut. Nowadays, we make such a small cut that we can't even find it. It takes longer. So you're busy looking for it after you're done. And certainly if you have the pull-apart challahs where you're not even going to cut it, there's no reason to make that cut. The whole reason the Shulchan Aruch says the cut is necessary is because we want it to go faster, because we want as small of a time lapse as possible in between the recitation of the bracha and the performance of the act. So that's one place where we find it. In Hilchos Tefillin, not sure, it might be something that some of us do, but Hilchos Tefillin, we're told as well. The bracha on the tefillin should not be made while the tefillin are on the table. The bracha should be made after the person has placed the tefillin on their hand and before they tighten the strap. Again, because if you're going to make the bracha while it's still on the table, that's too much in advance of the mitzvah. Similarly, in Siman Talef and Shacharit, we're told in the mitzvah of Dalet Minim, one has to make sure to make the bracha not while they're in the bag, not while the esrog is still in its box. You have to make sure to first pick it up and have it all ready, and only then can you recite the bracha. So this is something that we find all over the place throughout Shulchan Aruch, and Hilchos Tzitzis, we find it as well. But what's the problem that arises is, as many of us might know, on Sukkos. Now the problem is as follows. If you look carefully, what exactly is the nature of the mitzvah of shaking lulav on Sukkos? Anybody know? We call it shaking lulav. But what do I have to do in order to perform the act properly? What does the pasuk say? Ulakachtem lachem. What does that mean? Ulakachtem. You will take for yourself. So if you translate that very literally, it means pick up, hold a lulav and esrog, and you have performed your mitzvah. Well, says the Gemara in the first parak of Maseches Sukkah, that's all you need. All you need. Forget the shaking. The shaking was a later enactment that the rabbis tacked on. But the simple understanding of the mitzvah on Sukkos is pick up the lulav and esrog, and now you have performed your mitzvah. That's it. So we have a problem. The problem that's the Maseches Sukkah daf lamedtes is, well, how do we perform the bracha and the mitzvah of Dalet Minim? When is the bracha supposed to be recited? If I recite it while the lulav and esrog are on the table, that's too much in advance. If I recite it once I pick it up, well, I already finished my mitzvah. So 1 second, you know the answer, but that's not the only answer. So what are you supposed to do? This is the problem that the Rishonim are bothered with in Maseches Sukkah. How should one properly recite the bracha and perform the mitzvah of Dalet Minim when, if you pick it up already, your mitzvah's over? If you make the bracha beforehand, that's a violation of being too much in advance. So the Rishonim give 3 answers of what a person should do, 3 suggestions. Suggestion number 1 is the following. Pick up the lulav, the hadassim, and the aravos in one hand, leave the esrog on the table, recite the bracha, and then pick the esrog up. Okay. That's a little complicated. Hard to remember to do everything in the right order and to do it that way. So that's a little bit complicated. That's the answer number 1 that is suggested in the Rishonim. Answer number 2 that we find is the way we do it. Take the lulav and esrog, but have the esrog upside down. And if you have the esrog upside down, then you recite the bracha, then you flip the esrog right side up. Why does that help? Is it no longer an esrog because it's flipped upside down? Does anyone understand that? Well, that's what today's shiur is about. You wonder? Does that make any sense? What does it help to flip the esrog upside down? It's still an esrog. So what have you accomplished? That's what the shiur is going to be. And suggestion number 3 is the following. Pick up the lulav and esrog. Have in mind that you don't want to perform your mitzvah. Then you make the bracha. And then you have in mind that now the mitzvah is going to kick in. Now that's very complicated. And you shouldn't be surprised that if you look in Shulchan Aruch Siman Tav Reish Nun Aleph, only the first 2 suggestions are quoted and the 3rd one is totally left out. Why? The Taz says, because who's going to be able to have this in mind? Pick everything up, have in mind, I don't want to do my mitzvah. Now you make the bracha, but you're supposed to have in mind while you're reciting the bracha, you're supposed to have in mind that you're reciting a bracha and that you're doing the right thing. But now, after the bracha is over, now you're supposed to have in mind that you're performing a mitzvah. It's too complicated, therefore, Shulchan Aruch doesn't even quote that answer, that opinion. That's too complicated, so we leave that out of the picture. So we're left with the other two. And the other two, I assume that most of us have the practice of the other 2 options. Most of us have the practice of turning over the lulav and esrog. Now, That's a very strange kind of suggestion because, as we mentioned, what does it help? The Esrog is still an Esrog, the Lulav is still a Lulav, so why should it help if we flip it upside down? And there's a lot to talk about all the permutations of how one is supposed to shake Lulav and Esrog. We're not going to talk about it now because it's not Sukkot time for those who are not aware. Today is Rosh Chodesh Adar, so we're not going to talk about it now, but I do want to talk about this one idea because it's not only relevant to the halacha of Sukkot, of shaking the Lulav and Esrog, it's relevant to other areas of halacha as well. And where this really stems from is our parsha. We have in our parsha the mitzvah of building a mishkan. And as part of the building of the mishkan, one thing that they had to do was they had to take, crush them, they had to make beams and erect a structure, an edifice made out of these beams, which was going to be the structure of the mishkan. Now we're told you have to take atzei shittim, which means cedar wood, omdim. What does that mean, omdim? How do you translate that word?
Standing.
So what does it mean? You should take for yourself cedar wood that is standing. Now I ask any of you, I'm not an architect, but if you will take cedar wood and have it laying on the ground, do you think you're going to be able to construct a building? No. So what does this mean? Atzei shittim omdim. You need to make sure to have cedar wood that's standing up. Well, obviously, if you want me to build a building, I have to have cedar wood that is standing. So this is the problem that the Gemara is faced with. How do we understand that extra word, omdim? You have to have cedar wood that is standing. Of course it has to be standing. If you want to build a building, then the wood has to be standing up. So how do we understand that word? The Gemara here has three interpretations to that word, omdim. Let's read it together. Says the Gemara number Gimel. Mesecha Sukkah, daf mem hei amed beis. Amar Chizkiya, amar Rabbi Yirmiya, mishim Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. Kol ha-mitzvahs kulan, all mitzvah performance throughout the year. Ein adam yotze ela derech gedilasan. One is only able to perform a mitzvah throughout the year if you use the mitzvah item in its natural state of growth. Derech gedilasan. Shenemar, how do we know this is the case? Shenemar, because it says in our parsha, Parsha Shuma, atzei shittim omdim. Now, what does it mean that you have to have cedar wood that is standing? Says the Gemara, what it means is you have to chop down a tree and put it on the mishkan the way it grew from the ground, which is a very difficult thing to do. A very difficult thing to do. Sometimes you're going to have a tree, you're going to flip it upside down, right side up, you don't know exactly which way it grew on the ground. The Gemara tells us that that would have disqualified that wood from the mishkan. You have to put it exactly the way it grew. That's number one, and we extrapolate from here that not only by building the mishkan does the item have to be used in its proper natural state of growth, but also by all other mitzvahs that we perform throughout the year, we have to make sure to do it derech gedilasan. That's number one. Number two, says the Gemara, another thing we learn from this pasuk, Dabar Acher, Shema'amidim es Tzipuyan. Very simply, what was the structure of the mishkan? You have to erect a wall around the edifice, around the compound of the mishkan, and on top of that we had to put gold. We had to put a layer of gold on top of the outside structure of the mishkan. So, just practically, says the Gemara, Shema'amidim es Tzipuyan, it has to be strong enough that it can uphold the outer layer of gold that you're going to put on. So that's what atzei shittim omdim means. It means it has to be strong enough to stand, to withhold the gold coating that you're going to put on top. Okay? That's understanding number two into this word omdim. And number three, says the Gemara, dabar acher, perhaps a third understanding into what this word means, omdim, shema tomar, maybe you'll say, avad sivram ubatol sichuyan, maybe you'll say, once the mishkan is destroyed, so these walls are gone, the krushim are useless and they're not here anymore, and what do we need it for? Tamalomar, it's not true. Atzei shittim omdim, sha'omdim la'olam ula'omei olamim. That these beams are going to be everlasting. They will never be destroyed. We don't have a mishkan anymore. So Rashi explains that they sunk into the ground. Tavu ba'aretz she'areha. All these walls that they originally constructed as part of the mishkan sunk into the ground and they were never destroyed. So maybe that's what it means, omdim, that they last forever. Okay, so we have three interpretations into this word. Atzei shittim omdim. Number one, again, it's important that we know it. Number one, perhaps it means that you have to do a derech gedilasan, it has to be used exactly the way it grows. Number two, maybe it means shema'amidim es tzipuyan, they have to be strong enough to uphold the gold coating that we're going to put on the outside. And number three, what it means is shekayamim la'ad ulo'omei olamim, that they're going to last forever and ever, they are never going to be destroyed. Now, this idea of performing a mitzvah item in the way that it grows is a very interesting one. Let's turn our attention to Rashi, and everybody will notice the glaring omission in Rashi because it's so obvious. And if you don't notice it, just read it again, you'll notice it. Says Rashi, on that Gemara, that you have to perform all mitzvah items, derech gedilas, in the way they grow, notice what Rashi leaves out of this list. Kigon. What are the mitzvah items that one has to do in their upright position? Kigon, for example, Karshe HaMishkan, number one, when I'm building the Mishkan, I have to make sure that the wood beams for the outer structure of the Mishkan are put up, are constructed the way that they grew on the tree. Number two, Amudim, all the beams in the Mishkan also. Number three, Lulav. Number four, Hadas. Number five, Arava. All of those, Ein Adam Yotze Ela Derech Kedilasan. Anybody miss it? Esrog! Esrog! What's with the Esrog? And certainly the way we all practice, again, what is the reason why we flip the Esrog upside down? Now do we understand? What's the reason why we flip the Esrog upside down? Is because since one can never perform a mitzvah if it's not right side up, if it's not the way it grows on the tree, so if you flip it upside down, you are not performing your mitzvah. Well, if Rashi leaves Esrog out of the list, then we're back to our problem. If there's no insistence that an Esrog has to be taken only right side up, then we're back to the issue that we started with. When does one perform the mitzvah of Lulav and Esrog? How is one supposed to recite a bracha on it? And not following, is this clear? So what do we do? How does Rashi leave this out? What's the story? So there was a tremendous, brilliant Talmud Chacham. In the second half of the 1800s, he passed away, I think, in 1905. His name was Reb Shlomo HaKohen Mivilna. And he was the chief rabbi of Vilna for over 40 years. So he has a sefer, Binyan Shlomo, in which everything in there is just brilliant. And you see his brilliance throughout everything. So he suggests the following. Well, maybe you're right. Maybe we have an insistence that a lulav, hadasim and aravos, have to be taken in their right side up, in the position in which they grew. But an esrog, how does an esrog grow?
On the tree.
An esrog grows on the tree, but how does it grow? It starts growing right side up, and then when it gets too heavy, it flips to be upside down. So he says, maybe, since the esrog grows in both directions, we have no insistence by an esrog that you have to take it either way, because it really grows both ways. How do you like that? So he says, that's why Rashi leaves it out of the list. Why are you accepting this? How can you accept it? If you accept it, what? The bracha doesn't make sense, exactly. It's a very nice suggestion, but then how can we say that this is our way out of our problem? Again, on Sukkot, we're not sure. When do we recite the bracha? If I pick up the Dalet Minim, I'm Yotze my mitzvah right away, I can't make the bracha afterward. If I leave it on the table and I make the bracha then, it's too much in advance. So Tosfos says, well, what you should do is pick up everything, have the Esrog upside down, recite the bracha, then you flip it right side up. What do you mean? If there's no insistence on which way you take the Esrog, then how can you do that? It's not going to help. And this is why everybody disagrees with this brilliant insight, even though it's a great idea, but the Magen Avraham and Siman Tav Resh Nun Aleph says this is ridiculous. How can he say such a thing? It's not true. You can't assume like that. And don't think it's my word to say you're ridiculous. This is the Sefer HaManig. He's one of the Rishonim in the 1300s. Let's see what he writes. Dalet Minim Shevelulav. This is number Hey. All of the four Minim Shevelulav, which means Lulav, Esrog, Hadasim, and Aravos, all of them, Tzarech, one has to perform those mitzvahs in the natural state in which the items grow. And those fools, says the Sefer HaManig, that take the esrog, that they take the esrog upside down and they say, and they convince themselves, they say, well, that's the way an esrog grows. It flips halfway through, so that's the way it grows, so we may as well take it upside down. I have bad news for you, says the Sefer HaManig. I'm sorry, but you have never properly performed the mitzvah of shaking lulav and esrog on Sukkot. And therefore, we do not accept, and in fact, Rashi himself, you know, we're very familiar with Rashi on Chumash, with Rashi on Tanakh, with Rashi on the Gemara. Rashi has many different commentaries. What we might know is that Rashi and his students wrote other svarim that are very scarcely quoted. They're really not quoted a lot. One of those svarim is called the Sefer HaOra. That's what the Talmidim of Rashi wrote. And there in the Sefer HaOra, Rashi's Talmidim themselves write that one has to take the lulav, the esrog, the hadasim, and the aravos in the proper way. So you have to say, it's just a misprint over here. Rashi just left it out by mistake. But Rashi himself agrees, don't make a whole assumption, don't make a whole study out of this. Rashi himself agrees that obviously the esrog has to be taken right side up as well. Now, when it comes to the lulav, the problem is when you shake the lulav in various directions. So we shake it. What do? We shake it all four corners, and we go in front and back, and up and down. So, the Ramah talks about, what do you do when you go the down direction? Right? What do you do with the down direction? So the Rama says there were those who used to take the lulav and go like this, upside down. So the Rama says, well, that doesn't work because you're not taking it derech yedilasan. The lulav has to be shaken the way in which it grows. So you can't take your hands and flip them upside down and shake down that way. That's not going to work, says the Rama. Now, says the Mishnah Brura, if one has to take the dalad minim the way that they grow, the natural way of growth, then bishchiva, if you do it in a horizontal position, that's also not going to work. Why? Because they don't grow that way either. You have to take it in a vertical position. Well, now I understood, once I saw this Mishnah Brura, for many years I davened with my father as I was growing up. And I always saw that my father was the only one in shul who shook his lulav and esrog in a certain way. And I thought he was strange, you know? And my father, when he was raising us, never explained anything to us. He had his own things. He never told us anything. If you happen to notice, you notice. If you didn't happen to notice, it's, you know, it's your loss. So over here I was in shul every year, watching my father. He's the only one in shul that's shaking in a certain way, and everybody else is different. How did he shake? When he did all four sides, so how do we go? I think most people, when they go in front of them, they go like this. No? My father, always in shul, went like that. He kept his hands straight. For those who are listening on the recording later, I don't know how you're going to understand this, but my father always put his hands straight or put his hands in the other directions. He never let the lulav and esrog change direction itself. It was always that his hands moved, but the lulav and esrog always stayed in an erect position. Now, why is that? I always thought it was strange, but if you see this Mishnah Brura, who quotes from the Matan Moshe that if you do it b'shchiva, that's also a violation of derech yedilas, and that's not the way they grow on the tree. Well, now you understand why perhaps there's an insistence that one should also shake in all the directions in the proper way and always have the lulav and esrog in an upright position. Okay, so Sukkot time, if you're still here. Sukkot time. If you're still willing to come Sukkot, then we'll discuss it, maybe. There's a lot to talk about. Why did they institute in the first place? The Gemara says there's a whole symbolism here. Yeah, there's a whole symbolism behind all the different directions in which we shake. Now, there is a fascinating comment by the Aruch Laner. The Aruch Laner was Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, who was one of the staunch opponents of the Reform movement. He was the famous student of... I'm sorry, his most famous students were Rabbi Shamshon Raphael Hirsch and Rabbi Azriel Hildesheimer. So they were the two greats of the generation who took after his ways and were fighting vehemently against the Reform. So Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger has a sefer all about Dalad Minim, and it's called the Bikurei Yaakov, and there he suggests something fascinating. He said somebody asked him, if you live in Europe, so I don't know the geography well enough, but if you look at the other side of the globe, what would it be? Let's say, argument's sake, it's not Australia, but let's just say, argument's sake, it would be Australia. So he says, what if you get an esrog that came from Australia? So do you take it upside down because it grew the other way on the other side of the world? It seems to me like a ridiculous assertion to even assume such a thing, that maybe that's even a possibility, and we don't accept that at all. Obviously, what the Gemara means to say is, however, the esrog grows naturally on a tree. It doesn't matter what part of the world you get it from. You're supposed to take it right side up. But it's interesting, nonetheless, that he has this question. There were some who even wanted to extend it to the walls of the sukkah, that if a person is building a sukkah, you have to make sure to put them up in a direction in which they grew. Now, we all know that that's not the case. Why is it not the case? Because, as we know, there's no insistence that the walls have to be made out of wood. The walls can be made out of anything. And since there's no insistence what they're made out of, well, then it doesn't make a difference if you make it out of wood, it doesn't make a difference if you make it out of plastic or anything else. Therefore, there can certainly not be an insistence that it has to be the way that it grew, because it doesn't have to be used from that kind of item at all. So this is something which is an important concept, and now we understand what it is, the crux of the issue by Sukkot, why it is that we flip the esrog upside down, and why it is that we then flip it right side up, because again, if you do it upside down, one would not be in performance of the mitzvah properly. Now, for the rest of the shiur, I want to go on a digression a little bit and explain an idea that I thought made a lot of sense. I have never seen it in a sefer, but it's up to your consideration whether or not you will accept this. So we have a Gemara here that tells us three different things that we learn from this pasuk of Atzi Shitim Omdim. And that was, again, if you want to look back, it's number Gimel, where we're told Atzi Shitim Omdim, number one, either it means you have to take a derech kedilasan, has to be taken in the proper natural state of growth. Number two, it means Shema Amidim Es Tzipuyam, that it has to be strong enough to uphold all of the gold that you're going to put as a coating outside. And number three, the Gemara tells us it means Shekayamim La'adu La'omei Olam. I was thinking, perhaps this Gemara is metaphorical. Perhaps this Gemara not only teaches us the halacha, but it also it's illustrative a little bit of an idea in which we can all take with regard to all of our performance of mitzvahs throughout the year. And it's not only limited to what the Gemara here describes. I was thinking about the following. There's a story told about Rav Pam, that there was once a student that came to him. Rav Pam was the Rosh Hashiva in Tarav Adas. He was a very well-known person. He was known to be an Ish HaYasher, an absolutely straight individual, honest, with tremendous integrity. And there was once a student of his that came to talk to him about a business deal that he was about to go through. And he was talking to him about the transaction. He was saying he's going to do this and he's going to do that, and he's going to buy from this one and sell to the other one and have a company buy off the stocks and the shares and everything. He was telling him a whole convoluted story. And he was explaining to him in the end how much money he's going to make, and that he's going to give so much to the yeshiva, he's going to give tzedakah to here, and he's going to support this orphanage and that yeshiva and that kollel and this wonderful thing. And Rav Pam turned to him and he said, "Are you sure all of this is legal?" And the man said back to him, "Well, I figured out this loophole and that technicality, and I figured out how to buck the system by getting around this law and that law and the other one, because I'm going to have this partner and the other partner." And Rav Pam said to him the following. We're told by the Luchos when the Torah was given, Mizeh u'mizeh him ksuvim. What does that mean? It means there was a miracle. That from any direction that you looked, the Luchos were able to be read in their natural way. And Rav Pam said to him, for those who understand Yiddish, it will be extra special to read Rav Pam's words himself, a number above, As medrei tahin, ad medrei taher. If you're going to take the luchos and flip them this way or the other way, or upside down or inside out, is state nachals di aseres hadibros. It still says lo signov. And you can try to turn it on its head and flip it upside down and figure out how you're going to get around every loophole in the system, but it still says lo signov. And it was a very powerful understanding when I first heard it. That so often we do things and we say, well, I'm not really technically doing anything wrong, but the reason why the luchos were written mizeh u'mizeh him ksuvim is to teach us that no matter how much you spin it, no matter how much you twist it, and no matter how much you try to get around the system, you're still going to stare at those luchos in the face and read those same words. And that's what Rav Pam told his student. And I believe that Rav Pam's idea doesn't only apply to lo signov, but it applies to all of our mitzvah observance. How often do we have opportunities to perform a mitzvah, and we get ourselves out of it on a technicality? Yes, it might be true that the letter of the law tells us you might not have to perform it under these circumstances. Now, we spoke a couple of weeks ago, I got a lot of emails after the shiur about Kriya on the Makom HaMikdash, about ripping Kriya. And one of the main things that they teach us all when we go to camp in Israel is that on the bus, on your way into the old city, you should all switch shirts with each other, and therefore you won't have to rip Kriya. Why? Because technically the Gemara tells us in the Yerushalmi that if you're wearing somebody else's beged, you don't have a right to rip their clothing because it doesn't belong to you. Right? So that is the reason why everybody somehow gets out of the mitzvah of Kriya. Technically, are they correct? Probably not. But even if they are correct, it's wrong anyway. That Gemara is talking about, if I'm going to a wedding and I borrow a fancy suit or a gown from somebody and now I happen to find myself in the Makom HaMikdash, well, I'm not allowed to rip that person's gown because they didn't give it to me to go to the Makom HaMikdash and destroy it. It doesn't mean that if I'm on the bus on the way into the old city and we all know that we have an obligation to rip Kriya, it doesn't mean that if we swap shirts now, we're going to be able to get ourselves out of the obligation. That's obviously not what it means. So there's the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. And I think that's where Rav Pam teaches us. And I think perhaps maybe that's what we can learn from this Gemara as well, from the first understanding of Atzei Shitim Omdim. We have to perform all of our mitzvahs in the upright position. Not to drea hin and drea her and take it and upside down and figure out how are we going to get out of everything and how are we going to make sure that we're not going to be obligated to go to shul? How are we going to make sure that we're not going to be obligated to do all these wonderful things that we maybe perhaps would want to do, but we're going to figure out how to buck the system, how to get around on a technicality, on a loophole? We have to perform mitzvahs derech kedilas and the way they were meant to be performed. We all know good and well what God wants from us sometimes, and we're just not in the mood. And we get out of it because we're just not in the mood. And that's not the opportunity of performing mitzvahs that we're supposed to have. It's not the outlook that we're supposed to be having. And that's perhaps the first idea that our Gemara teaches us. We have a pasuk in Parshas Bahaloscha, where we're told that upon the construction of the chatzotzros, so they had to be made miksha achas. The chatzotzros had to be made of one piece of silver, one piece of gold. Now, it's very difficult to make something out of one piece of silver. It's much easier to take a bunch of different pieces and put it together and construct an item. Not only do we find by the construction of the chatzotzeros that they had to be made out of one piece, but we find it by two other items in the Beis HaMikdash as well. What were they? The menorah and the kruvim. Now can you imagine? The kruvim, we're told, had to be children's faces with intricate details, with wings and everything, and they had to be connected to the top of the yaron. I don't think it's so simple to make kruvim with all of those nuance out of one piece of gold. Would it not have been easier to take a wing from here and a wing from over there and a face of a child, and then you construct it and put it all together, glue it together, and then you have a beautiful kruvim? So the Reish Rav writes in his Sefer, Hadrash V'Ha'iyun, why is it that we find by these three items specifically that they had to be made miksha achas, they had to be made out of one piece of silver, one piece of gold? Why is that? Would it not have been easier if they constructed it piece by piece? And it's just the following, because each one of these three is talking about a different area of life where sometimes we try to make shortcuts. He says, number one, the menorah is a symbolism to our Torah, our mitzvah observance. As we say, ki ner mitzvah v'torah or. All of our Torah observance, all of our mitzvah observance is highlighted in the menorah. Ki ner mitzvah v'torah or. And he suggests, how often do we try to figure out the shortcut to get around the mitzvah? Yes, there's an easy way of building a menorah. You can take piece by piece and figure out how you're going to put it together, but it's not going to be as strong. The strongest way to build a menorah is to have it out of miksha achas. And if we want, he says, if we want our Torah, our mitzvah observance to be strong, to be firm, to have roots and foundations, and to make God really proud, we have to do it the hard way. Not just with all the shortcuts. Not to buck the system. There are no shortcuts. You know, everybody always tells me, it's interesting growing up in a house of a Gadol B'Yisrael. It's a strange kind of experience that I assume most of us don't have. But I had it, and I continue to have it. And everybody always told me, well, wow, your father's such a genius. And it really offended me when people said that. Because yes, you all hear him speak and you say, wow, he's a brilliant man. But I watch him work really hard. And I can tell you, I am now 30 years old, as of last week. And I'm an old man, yes. I can tell you that in my 30 years knowing my father, I've never in my life ever seen my father without a sefer in his hand. Ever. Ever. We have never gone anywhere where my father does not have a sefer. In every single one of our weddings in our family, there is a picture in every single child's album of my father at some point in the wedding when there was downtime in between the pictures. How much time do we all waste? There was always downtime. There's a picture of my father that the photographer happened to take on his own because he was inspired by it, of my father sitting on the side with everyone else running around and wasting time, sitting with a sefer open and learning. It's not that he doesn't care about the family. It's not that he doesn't care about us. It's that he doesn't waste time, and that's the way you become great. It's the hard way. But that's the way you become great. It's not because you're a genius. There are no shortcuts. There are no shortcuts to becoming a great person in Torah or in mitzvah observance. It doesn't work. And that's why, explains the Reish Rav in Drash V'Ha'iyun, this is why the menorah had to be made miksha achas. Because it's coming to teach us that this is the only way to have a proper and an eloquent mitzvah and Torah observance. Then he goes to the chatzotzros. And he says the chatzotzros were used by Moshe Rabbeinu le'orer es'am. That was his way of communicating. And he says in leadership it's the same thing. If a leader is going to take shortcuts and buckle to pressure, what kind of leader are you? One has to make sure that there are no shortcuts, that one always stands up firm for the right thing. If one is a leader, you have to make sure to be miksha, to be strong, to be firm, that it has to be with strong foundations, and you cannot buckle to pressure, and you cannot buckle to certain things. And finally, he says, the kruvim, as we know, kruvim are the symbolism of two young children. And he says there are two ways that one can raise children as well. There's the easy way, finding shortcuts, and then there's the difficult way, dealing with the issues head on. And he says, if we want to be successful in raising our children, our grandchildren, and in making sure that the next generation will continue the heritage that we want them to continue on, there are no easy answers, there are no easy directions. It always has to be done miksha achas. It's a difficult thing. It's a hard way to do it, but that is the only way to do it, he suggests. And I believe when you put all this together and you think about the context of the Gemara, and you think about the story about Rav Pam, that mitzvahs have to be observed without shortcuts. There is no such thing as shortcuts. One will never grow to be as great as they can be by taking shortcuts. It just doesn't work. And maybe that's the first understanding that we can walk away with from this Gemara of Atzei Shitim Omdim, that the mitzvahs have to be observed throughout the year, derech gedilasan, in their natural way, in the way that we know God wants us to perform them, without finding all the loopholes, without getting out on the technicalities. We go next to the second piece, and that is, our Gemara tells us that from the word omdim we learn, shema'amidim es tzipuyam, that they have to be strong enough to uphold all of the gold and all of the silver that are going to be coated on the outside. I was thinking about the story about Rabbi Arye Levine. Rabbi Arye Levine was known as the great tzaddik of Yerushalayim. And they say in his biography that he went into a store on Erev Sukkos, and for anyone who's ever been to Yerushalayim on Erev Sukkos, it's very wild, and everyone is looking at a srogim, and everyone is looking with their magnifying glasses and getting very carried away with choosing out the best and the perfect esrog. And Rabbi Arye Levine walked into a store, and he asked them, he says, I want to spend X amount of dollars. They give him an esrog, he doesn't even look at it, he throws it into his pocket, walks out of the store. And somebody comes over to him in the street and he says, I don't understand. Every young child who walks in to buy an esrog is looking so carefully, is checking, is scrupulating, is making sure with a magnifying glass that there's nothing wrong with this perfect esrog. I want it just the way it should be. What's with you, Rabbi Levine? How come you just run in and you run out? Why don't you care at least to look at it? And Rabbi Levine suggested that there are two different places where we find the mitzvah of hiddur in the Torah. One is Lakachtam Lachem Pri Eitz Hadar. We have to take a esrog which is beautiful, and that's why people get very carried away with finding a beautiful esrog, because they want to make sure that their hiddur is up to par. And the second place, said Rabbi Levine, is Behadarta Pnei Zakin. We have an obligation to show respect and to show dignity to elderly people. Said Rabbi Levine, while everyone in the world is busy with hiddur number one of Pri Eitz Hadar on Erev Sukkos, I took it upon myself to make sure that I do my best to show the other hiddur how important it is. And I spend my time in Erev Sukkos going into all the nursing homes for, unfortunately, all the older people who are not able to make it and spend the Sukkos like the rest of us. I give all of my time to Vehadarta Pnei Zakin, because that's just as important. And Rabbi Levine teaches us in this story that one always has to make sure to be congruous in both areas of life. It always has to be compatible. You can't just have hiddur in one area and then be totally deficient in the other area. You know, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, who was the father of the Musar movement. So Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, we're told, was a man who was very careful about everything he did. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, one of the stories that his students tell about him is that he was very careful in the way he baked matzahs. And he had so many chumras. And his students spoke to him and they said, now that we're moving away from the yeshiva and we're not going to be able to bake matzahs with you anymore and we're going to move to our own communities, what would you tell us, what's the most important chumra that we should take upon ourselves while baking the matzahs? What do you say when we're going to bake our own matzahs without you? And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said to them, you know what the most important chumra is? When you have the almana who's sitting and cleaning up the matzah bakery after all of you are done with your work, make sure you bend down on the floor to hold a dustpan while she's sweeping. And make sure that you give her a drink after she's done. And make sure you say thank you. And make sure that you show your appreciation for everything she's doing for you to make sure that you have matzos that are proper for Pesach. That, said Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, is above and beyond all other chumras that we can possibly come up with in the mitzvah of baking matzah. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said on another occasion that he was once visiting a person's home and they gave him water for Netilas Yadayim to wash his hands before the meal. And they were all looking at him how it's very strange that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was being so skimpy with the water and he was just taking the exact perfect amount to wash his hands, when in Shulchan Aruch it says one should take as much as possible in order to make sure that your hands are really clean. And they asked Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, how come you're not being careful to take so much water like the Shulchan Aruch ascribes? And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said, Chashavti, I thought to myself, Shalom in Hadin. It just doesn't make sense. Lahader al cheshbonam uksefam shalacher. I know how much effort it takes for the water carrier to schlep all the water from the well up to your house. I'm going to sit here and take upon myself a chumrah to use more water when I know that it's going to be on someone else's back? How can I do such a thing? It just doesn't make sense. It's inconsistent. It's not the same person. If you look in last week's Parsha, we have in Parshas Mishpatim number Ches, a time on the occasion of Kabbalah Satorah, so we know the Jewish people had to offer karbanos. And Moshe Rabbeinu, if you look at the second half of this pasuk, Vayikach Moshe es hadam, Vayizrok al ha'am. Moshe Rabbeinu takes half of the blood from all of the karbanos that were offered. He takes half of the blood and he sprinkles it onto the people. and he takes the other half and he sprinkles it onto the Mizbeach. Suggests Rav Hudner in the Pachad Yitzchak on a Sefer on Shavuos, what it means is that we have to make sure to be corresponding, both in our relationship with the people and in our relationship with the Mizbeach. You take half of the blood and you put it on the Mizbeach. You take the other half of the blood and you put it onto the people, because both of those must always be congruous. A person can't excel in one area and be the closest person to God if your Ben Yadam L'Chaver is just not up to par. It just doesn't make sense. I saw an amazing, really amazing insight. We say every day in Kriya Shema, V'haya lachem l'tzitzis, a person has an obligation to make tzitzis, u re'isem oso, and you should look at them, u'zachartem es kol mitzvos Hashem va'asisem oso. Okay, very simple pasuk. You should look at the tzitzis, and that will remind you of all of the mitzvah, all of the Torah observance. Says the Gemara in Brachos Daf Tesam at Beis, Ma'em asai korin es hashma b'shachris. When are we supposed to, when is the proper time to recite Kriya Shema in the morning? Simple question. I wake up at 5 in the morning to go to the gym. Can I say Shema already? Why not? So what is that time? That's what the Gemara is bothered with. And here, one of the opinions in the Gemara is Acherim Omrim, Mishayira Eschavero, Berichuk Dalad Amos V'yakirenu. When it's light enough outside that you can see somebody 4 Amos away and recognize who they are. That's the time that it's proper to say Kriya Shema. And some suggest, perhaps metaphorically, what it means is, you know when the right time to say Kriya Shema is? You know when the right time to connect yourself to God is and show Him your allegiance? It's only Mishayira Eschavero Berichuk Dalad Amos V'yakirenu. When you're in a position that you see other people and understand, and you recognize V'yakirenu, and you understand their pain, and you understand what they're up to, and you have done your best to make sure that your Ben Adam L'Chavero is up to par, only then is it the right and proper time to say Kriya Shema. That's perhaps what the Gemara means here. It's an incredibly powerful insight. And I think when you look back at this Gemara that we started with, Atzei Shitim Omdim, where we're told that they have to be done in a way which is Ma'amidim Es Tzipuyim. They have to be strong enough to uphold all of the gold that is going to be coated on the outside of them. And I thought perhaps this is a very important lesson for us as well. How often do we have gold and we have the beautiful menorah and the silver ka'ara and we have all the beautiful hiddur that we have throughout all the mitzvah observance throughout the year, but what's the person that's standing behind all of that? Who is upholding all of that hiddur? Are we really able to be congruous? Are we really saying, are we up to par in both areas of life? Are we making sure that we're able to uphold to our best all of that gold and silver that we have parading around the streets? All of our ulakachtam lachem priyei tzadar, is that really with the vahadarta p'nei zakim, with the caring, with the compassion that we're supposed to have inside for other people? That's perhaps what this Gemara teaches us, that we need to make sure shema'amidim es tzipuyim, that we're strong enough on the inside to uphold all of the gold coating, all the layer that's going to be on the outside. There's a story about Rav Matal Katz, who was the Rosh Hashiva and tells Cleveland. So he was once on a plane, and he said he was sitting next to an irreligious Jew, and the Jew turned to him and he says, you know, Rabbi, I don't understand something. How often do I read, unfortunately, in the newspaper that there's an Orthodox Jew who's cheating on his income taxes, who's not being honest with the government, who's stealing from other people? How do you explain these Jews? How are they Orthodox Jews? I don't understand. Don't they know that the Torah says you're not allowed to steal? So he turned to him and he says, you know, I have a question for you. He says, yes. He says, you know, I'm trying to understand for the longest time, what's with those Orthodox Jews that drive to shul on Shabbos? How do you explain them? It just doesn't make sense to me. And he turns back to me and says, well, they're not Orthodox. And Rav Matal Katz said, well, neither are they. Why do we believe that it's different to drive to shul on Shabbos than to cheat someone else in business? It's the same Torah, it's the same God. And in fact, the very first obligation that we have right after Kabbalah Satorah and Parshas Yisro is Parshas Mishpatim. What are we told in Parshas Mishpatim? All about Dinei Mamonos. All about respecting other people's property. All about being fair and honest in our business. This is the first lesson that we're taught immediately following Kabbalah Satorah, because it's the most important thing to think about. It's something we need to remind ourselves of all the time. This is why when we have children who are starting to learn Gemara, the first parak in Gemara that we teach them universally, I don't know if anybody knows, Eila Metzias. Why? Eila Metzias is the parak in Gemara that's about finding somebody else's property. What am I supposed to do with it? Is that the most important thing a kid needs to know? Shouldn't we start teaching about Kriya Shema, about Tefillah, about everything else? No. Because the most important thing to teach a child is how to respect other people's privacy, how to respect other people's property, how to make sure that everything that they come across in their lives has to be carefully weighted. Does this really belong to me or does it not? And that's perhaps what we're taught in this Ma'amidim Es Tzipui. And you can be the biggest Eved Hashem in the world, but if we're lacking in that person that stands behind all of the beautiful Hidur Mitzvah, if it's not going to be congruous, then it's worthless. Moshe Rabbeinu takes half of the blood and sprinkles it on the people, and the other half he sprinkles on the Mizbeach. And finally, the last idea that the Gemara teaches us is Atzei Shitim Omdim means that they're Kayam La'ad U'la'ome Olamim, that they have to be everlasting, and they have to be of everlasting nature. That's what we're taught with the Krushim of the Mishkan. And perhaps this is also a reference to our point about mitzvah observance. What that means is that mitzvah observance was given at one point in history, that the Torah was given at the time of Kabbalah Satorah, but it's something that applies in every generation. It's Kayam La'ad U'la'ome Olamim. It's something that is everlasting and it's never going to change. Zos HaTorah Lo Tehe Mochlefes. This is a Torah that is never going to be changed. It's something that is never subject to change whatsoever. It's the same Torah that we had from a few thousand years ago. It's Kayam La'ad U'la'ome Olamim. We're told a story about Reb Tzvi Hirsch Levine, that he once came across it's a fascinating story. He once came across one of the leaders of, I don't know if it was the conservative or the reform movement. It was the Maskilim. So I don't know how exactly you categorize the Maskilim. But they had a conversation. What? He enlightened, yeah, I don't know exactly the year, so I don't know what generation, what time period it was about. But basically, this person's name was David Friedlander, the head of the Maskilim. And they had a conversation. And David Friedlander said to him, I don't understand. Ani batuach, he says to him, I am sure, she'omale Moshe Rabbeinu hayachai b'tkufazu. If Moshe Rabbeinu lived in our times, bivadai hayakose b'torah kefirua chazman. He would have written the rules differently. It doesn't make sense. There's no way he would have written the rules the way he did so many thousands of years ago. It just can't be. And he has a great question. And it's a great question. And listen to how Rav Tzvi Hirsch Levine answered him back. It's so brilliant. It's so beautiful the way he said. He says, you know, there was once a businessman who asked to go from Leipzig to Warsaw. I don't know how far it was. But apparently in Warsaw, that was where the big Yerid was. That was where the big show, the big fair was. And he had to go to sell his goods. So he goes and he hires an agalon. He hires a wagon driver. And he asks him, I would like you to take me to Warsaw from Leipzig. The deal is I will pay you X amount of dollars. If I get there late, you are not being paid anything. I need to get there on time. I have all my wares with me. I have to be there for the show. If we're not going to get there in time, you're not getting paid anything because this trip is worthless. Okay, so it's in the middle of January, and he has to get there. So they say, fine, they make a deal, they shake hands, and they sign a whole document and everything. A deal is a deal. They're on their way, and all of a sudden it starts raining, and the horse gets stuck in the mud, like every good Hasidus Shemaisa. Horse gets stuck in the mud, and they can't move, and he's digging, and he's schlepping, and he's everything. They keep moving. The next day it starts snowing and it starts hailing and they get so caught up and he can't travel and they finally get to Warsaw and the show is over. The businessman turns to the wagon driver and he says to him, I'm sorry, we made a deal. Here's the document. We shook hands. We signed on it. If you don't get me there on time, you're not getting paid. I'm sorry, you're not getting paid anything. And for that matter, I want you to pay me for all the business that I lost as well. He says to him, excuse me, I know that we signed, but when we signed, did we think that there was going to be a rainstorm and a hailstorm and snowing and everything? How could it be? So they're having this big disagreement. It wasn't my fault. I tried my best. It's not like I just stopped on the side of the highway. I tried my best to get you there. I'm sorry that we missed it. So they go to the Rav, they go to the Beis Din, and they ask to have a Din Torah. And they start discussing the case. And the rabbi says to them, well, you signed a document, and the document says that if you don't get there in time, you're not getting paid. So he says, don't you believe in the concept of onas rachmana patri? It's not my fault. And when something is not my fault, I'm not held accountable. And the rabbi says back to him, yes, you're right, but the truth is, you signed the document. So if you signed, you signed. The deal is a deal. What can you do? So he asks back to the rabbi, can you tell me, when was the Torah given? The rabbi says to him, when was the Torah given? We all celebrate Kabbalah Satorah on Shavuos. It was given in Sivan. And can you tell me, what month are we in now? He says, Teves. We're in the middle of January. We're in the middle of December. Well, yes, you're right that the Torah says I would have to pay. That's because the Torah was given in the summertime. And the Torah was given in the summertime. They never expected there to be a storm like this. Had the Torah been given in Teves, of course I wouldn't have to pay. Of course I wouldn't have to pay. And this is the answer that Rabbi Levine gave back to this David Friedlander. He said to him, as ridiculous as that wagon driver sounds, that's the same question that you have. Had the Torah been given now, would it not have been given differently? Would Moshe Rabbeinu not have changed the rules, kifi ruach hazman? That's like saying, if the Torah would not have been given in Sivan, in the summertime, perhaps the rules would have changed. And I wouldn't be obligated to pay. We all know that that's ridiculous. And perhaps this is what our Gemara teaches us. Shekayamim la'ad ul'olmei olamim. Our opportunity that we have to be involved in mitzvah observance is something that, number one, has to be everlasting. It speaks to us in every generation. It never changes. It's immutable. And that's, number one, what we're taught. And number two, kayamim la'ad ul'olmei olamim, sometimes we're involved in a mitzvah and we say, well, how great of a mitzvah is it already? What's the big deal? God doesn't really need my mitzvah. Do you know that the Gemara tells us in Kiddushin, Schar mitzvah b'hai al maleka? There is no such thing as getting reward in this world for any mitzvah observance that we do throughout our lives. Why is that? Is that fair? I have to wait till I die? I have to wait till I get upstairs? Then I'm going to be rewarded? Why? Why is that fair? And the Mefarshim explained the reason why is because the reward that we get for a mitzvah is eternal. How can we possibly be paid back in this world, which is just ephemeral? It doesn't make sense. We can never be paid back enough in this world for something that we deserve for a mitzvah observance. This is another idea what it means. Shekayamim la'adu la'olmei olam. Our mitzvah observance is something that is so eternal in its very nature. It's something that we should never think, well, what's the big deal anyway? Does God really need my mitzvah? Do you know how much reward you're going to get for that small act? For that small deed? It's an incredible act, it's an incredible deed, and it's so great that God can't even figure out how to pay you in this world. That's how great it is. It's kayam la'adu la'olmei olam. It's an amazing act that you're involved in. And this perhaps is what the Gemara teaches us in all three of these ideas from our parsha. Number one, we have to make sure that we always perform our mitzvahs derech to the lesson, that they're performed in the upright position without always looking for a loophole, without looking for a technicality on how to get out. Number two, Shema Amidim Es Tzipuyen, we have to always make sure that we are the people upholding all of the coding, all of the gold that's on the outside of our mitzvah observance. Make sure the person on the inside is congruous with that same person that has all that gold. That's making sure that they have the Pri'etz Hadar. Make sure that you give equal attention to V'Hadarta Pnei Zaken. And number three, that the mitzvahs are kayam la'adu la'olmei olam. They are of everlasting nature. They will never change. Had Moshe Rabbeinu given the Torah in our times, it would have been exactly the same, because the Torah is a Torah's emes. It's the truth, and truth never changed. Truth is immutable. Truth is something that we can never change for anything else. And also that our mitzvah observance is kayam la'adu la'olmei olam. It's something we will be paid back in an eternal way. It's something we can never imagine. Ayin lo rasa elokim zulasecha, the Gemara says. It's something we cannot even fathom, the amount of reward that we're going to get for our mitzvah observance. Okay, mitzvah Hashem.